This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Lynn Muck, and this is the Best of the Breakfast Grill for 2020. We're featuring highlights from interviews on the show throughout the year, and today's focus is geopolitics. The US-China rivalry continued to dominate international headlines, and fault lines were only exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. Although the year began on a positive note with a Phase 1 trade deal between the two superpowers, relations quickly turned sour as COVID-19 spread beyond China to other parts of the world. US President Donald Trump blamed China for mishandling the outbreak and accused the World Health Organization of colluding in a cover-up. The bad blood culminated in the US withdrawing from the WHO in July, and we discussed the move with Kamala Lakhdir, the US ambassador to Malaysia.
So clearly, a global coordinated approach is the right step forward, right, to deal with COVID-19.
I think there is no choice, yes.
But at the same time, President Trump is terminating U.S. relationships with, let's say, the World Health Organization, WHO, and all funding, right? And you're the biggest contributor at 15%. So I'm not saying that, you know, WHO doesn't have its flaws, but, you know, does this leave a gap in the global effort to overcome COVID-19 or even some of the other public health problems like polio eradication? Doesn't this seem rather ill-timed?
So I think there were, as President Trump and the administration were clear, there were deep concerns about how WHO had responded and their outreach. I know that WHO is, in fact, having an independent I think it's a commission. Maybe I've used the wrong term, to look at themselves and to reevaluate what they did and what they didn't do and how to improve for the future. I think there is still a lot of multilateral work. I know the United States is talking with a lot of countries about vaccines and development of vaccines, because I think that will be a huge aspect where no one country – we have to vaccinate the world in order to defeat COVID-19. And so I think the United States is continuing to work with countries all over the world. One of the things that's very clear is our universities and our epidemiologists from the beginning to this day are working together how we will be able to develop the vaccine and then commercialize its production. And then the hardest thing is distribute it and deploy it across the world, which will take a huge logistics effort. So these things the United States is talking to lots of countries about, including Malaysia.
But there is some concern that U.S. will use its muscle as a superpower, right, to secure all these supplies of vaccine if it happens. You know, this vaccine nationalism approach. And we see that with the case with Remdesivir, where U.S. bought almost all the stock for the next 3 months. I mean, one of the two drugs proven to work against COVID-19, leaving nothing much for the rest of the world. So how do we know that U.S. will act in the interests of everyone else, you know?
Because a vaccine and defeating a pandemic requires a global response in order to defeat it. You cannot be – this is true of every country. You cannot stay home. We have learned through this experience. We are a global society, in fact. When you shut yourself completely off, your economies, the impact on your economy, as we can see in the United States, in Malaysia, even New Zealand, this is part of the complexity of our response to COVID-19. So that requires the vaccine to be administered globally to protect everyone. We, as a world, have to continue to work together.
That was U.S. Ambassador Kamala Lakhdir speaking with Wang Xiaoning in August. The U.S. pullback from multilateralism is part of the broader U.S.-China tensions that have been developing over the past few years, which some observers see as akin to the new Cold War. Wang Xiaoning spoke to David Dollar, a China expert with the Brookings Institution, on the cost of a protracted U.S.-China trade war.
I think it all started quite innocuously from U.S. imposing tariffs to some saying it's actually the new Cold War. The last one lasted 40 years, unfortunately. And, you know, what does this mean actually for globalization? And will the benefits which we have seen, especially in Asia and emerging markets, will it be rolled back?
Well, I think the tariffs that the Trump administration has imposed, this is a pretty significant step backwards in globalization. First, it's not just China. Trump administration has imposed tariffs on quite a few other partners. But the big guns were aimed at China. Right now, about half of China's exports to the U.S. are taxed by the U.S. at 25%, which is a pretty significant level of protection. Now, this is not working out well for the United States at all. This was supposed to help with the trade balance, but it hasn't. Because what happens is the U.S. is importing less from China, but a lot of those imports have shifted over to countries like Vietnam, I know for sure, maybe Malaysia, Indonesia, Mexico. So the U.S. is importing more than ever before. And then this kind of trade war tends to cut down your exports. So the U.S. is having a very poor year in terms of exports. Beyond the effect of the COVID recession, the U.S. is really missing out on a lot of market opportunities. So there's a sense in the U.S. that the trade war is not working out for the U.S., but the administration is pretty committed to it. One aspect are the tariffs I just mentioned, but the U.S. is also taking aim at China's high-tech companies like Huawei and Tencent and Alibaba, ByteDance, which is the owner of the TikTok app. So the U.S. is imposing a lot of sanctions on Chinese high-tech companies for national security reasons. The way I see that policy, the administration keeps flip-flopping. Initially, it looked like it was going to kill TikTok, and then they just reached a deal where actually not much is going to change. So you do see quite a bit of flip-flopping. It's frankly bad for business, both U.S. and Chinese companies don't like this uncertainty. It's probably one factor that's leading to the poor performance of the U.S. economy. But I suspect the U.S. is going to stick with some of this hostility toward the high-tech companies from China.
But if we look at the current situation, you know, what has happened is that it seems very much, especially the smaller economic countries like Malaysia, Vietnam, or Indonesia, or even Singapore, we have kind of forced to almost choose sides between America and China, especially in things like technology. So do we go with Huawei, for example, for 5G, or do we choose a non-Chinese player? How do we avoid having to choose sides and almost being like collateral damage?
Well, I think some decoupling in the technology area is inevitable. The U.S. is not going to let Huawei come in and supply equipment to the 5G network in the U.S., and many countries are taking the same attitude. So I'm hoping we can get to a realistic compromise. Yeah, there are a lot of areas that are closed off in the Chinese economy. Our social media companies like Facebook, Twitter, they can't operate in China at all. Google cannot operate in China at all. So the question is, can we agree that there's some high-tech areas where we're not going to have integration, but then allow most trade and investment and student exchanges and joint research? That, to me, the rational thing is to wall off a small number of high-tech areas with security implications, but then otherwise, let the economies be integrated. And I know that's difficult, but kind of bring it back to a country like Malaysia. My sense is you don't want to have to choose between dealing with China and dealing with the U.S. You would like to have economic relationships with both. China is going to be the fastest growing big economy for the foreseeable future. It'll eventually be the biggest economy. There's a lot of economic advantage for Vietnam, Malaysia, nearby countries to deal with China. So I think any effort on the part of the U.S. to try to isolate China is likely to fail. And the risk is we end up isolating the United States.
That was China expert David Dollar. He's also the co-author of the book China 2049, Economic Challenges of a Rising Global Power, which was published this year. President Trump's foreign policy, especially its hardline stance against China, is controversial within the international community. However, a change in administration will not likely see the U.S. alter its approach towards China, according to Murray Hebert, author of the book Under Beijing's Shadow. I spoke to him in the wake of the November presidential elections after the race was called for former Vice President Joe Biden. But of course, let's start with the biggest, most recent news that the U.S. presidential election has been called by media outlets for former Vice President Joe Biden. Now, how is this going to affect the balance of power with China here in Southeast Asia?
Well, I think one thing that Biden made clear during the election campaign is that many of the policies toward China that the Trump administration had introduced would likely continue. There's a growing consensus in the U.S. that China has, you know, taken advantage of the U.S., has stolen intellectual property rights, has forced companies to transfer their technology to China. And there's also a growing frustration about China's behavior in the South China Sea. It's very aggressive behavior toward other claimants like Malaysia, Vietnam, and the Philippines. So I think we're going to see some continuation of the pressure on China. However, I think Biden is generally a little less sharp-elbowed than is Trump. And I think, you know, he will look for ways to engage China in various ways, such as climate change, for example. He wants to re-engage the Paris Agreement and is looking to engage with other powers on climate. And so that will require cooperating with China. He will also likely look to China to cooperate on Iran's nuclear proliferation program, which the U.S. and China and Europe had already cooperated on. So I think it'll be pressure on China, but I don't know that he will get rid of tariffs anytime soon. It might take a while, but it'll really depend on whether China wants to negotiate with him as well.
What is your sense of the Chinese government's reaction to this news then, to kind of give us a picture of how China might react to a Biden administration?
The comments that I've heard out of China suggest that China does not think that they're going to go back to the good old days, let's say even early President Obama or late President George W. Bush, that it's going to be a tougher slog, that they are much more competitors now than they were before. And so it's going to, they anticipate that Biden will be tougher on them than he might have been during the Obama administration when he was vice president.
That was Asian expert and author Murray Hebert. We'll have more from the Best of the Breakfast Grill after these messages. When we return, we'll explore how the tussle for influence between the US and China is impacting the Southeast Asian region in the time of COVID-19. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, I'm Lynn Mark, and you're listening to the Best of the Breakfast Grill 2020, the Geopolitics Edition. The COVID-19 pandemic has impacted not only the US-China dynamics, but also the regional balance of power in Southeast Asia, as charted by the Lowy Institute's latest Asia Power Index. I discussed the findings of the study with Hervé Lemayeu and Alyssa Leng, the researchers behind the annual index, and what this means for US-China influence in the region.
I think the next decade is a very crucial one for China and for China's ascendancy. Across the 3 years that we've conducted this assessment, the power gap between China and the US has narrowed. Now, where everyone knows it does well is in terms of its comparative advantages over the United States in economic capability, in terms of its ability to control a substantial portion of regional trade flows and supply chains. However, I would say we should probably manage our expectations a bit, in the sense that China is also a rapidly aging country. It's set to lose 177 million people from its working age populations between now and the mid-century point. And the most pronounced weakness, or the Achilles heel really of China, is in terms of its defense diplomacy. There are 11 neighbors of China with whom it has disputed boundaries with. And this in itself, I think, will inhibit the ability of China to replace the United States as a security guarantor. There is not enough trust in China's long-term ambitions for China to really play that kind of hegemonic role of providing regional security. And therefore, we can't necessarily expect that the end of a unipolar US-led order automatically translates into a Chinese-led regional order. I think that is a bit too simplistic.
And is this assuming that the US also continues in the trajectory that we have seen it take across the past decade or so? Because at least in terms of your ranking change in 2020, the US was the biggest loser. It lost 3 points in its overall score. And we have seen the US struggle in the past to address the issue of a rising China. What are your expectations for the US's role going forward into the next decade or so?
Sure. They have lost the unipolar moment, almost irrespective of what takes place in the coming election. So a different administration to the one that we currently have could succeed in rapidly changing the narrative. So if the US wants to continue to play a leading role in Asia, it will need to work through partnerships, and it will have to understand that the way in which you maintain a favorable balance of power is not simply through a military alliance system, but also in terms of an economic balance of power, where the US needs to play its role in terms of the multilateral trade initiatives that are emerging here in this region.
So what do you anticipate will be the reactions of the other middle powers as well in the Asian region, considering that the Asian region is made up primarily of these middle powers? Will we see a kind of a bipartisan divide within the region? And where might that demarcation be, if so?
I'm not sure that I see sort of a divide in that sense, but I would think that the natural inclination, or perhaps a good path to go down for, would be for Southeast Asian countries to sort of rally around each other, whether it's through the ASEAN grouping or supporting each other in forums at the UN when they vote together and things like this. Because actually, despite the fact that there's great diversity in countries in Southeast Asia, particularly within ASEAN, actually, most countries in this sub-region actually derive their power from very similar bases. ASEAN countries get more of their power from diplomatic influence than anything else. So actively participating in ASEAN actually pays dividends for their powers. And another point that's important to remember is that the economic relationships of Southeast Asian countries matter more for their power than their own domestic economic capabilities, which makes sense given that relative to the giants in the region like the US and China, their economies are quite small. So I think it will remain important for Southeast Asian countries to engage with each other and more broadly in the region on matters that people can agree on, such as trade and investment through new agreements and such.
That was Hervé Lemayou and Alyssa Leng of the Lowy Institute. Meanwhile, Southeast Asian nations have long been walking a tightrope with the giant in our backyard, both courting socio-economic ties with China, but also wary of its military ambitions. Asian expert and author Murray Hebert weighed in on how the pandemic might affect how the region engages with China moving forward. As a region, historically, we've not done very well in providing a balance against China, partly due to the very diverse nature of the countries involved. So, in the wake of a global pandemic, and with the repositioning of major superpowers as well in the West, will Southeast Asia and ASEAN be able to bridge that gap, or will COVID only make divisions between these countries worse?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, one of the problems that I felt doing my research on how individual countries were responding to China was to see that every country was going its own way, trying to have its own bilateral ties with China instead of cooperating with each other. I mean, if the countries in Southeast Asia had compared notes, they would, for example, find that that Malaysia on its East Coast Rail Link is paying a higher percentage of interest than is Laos, and that China would charge Thailand if Thailand were to agree to a rail link. So far, they haven't. And I also thought that it was somewhat surprising that while China was pushing around a Shell off the coast of Malaysia and Rosneft, the Russian company, off the coast of Vietnam, they were actually pretty close. But they did not really compare notes what China's doing or try to cooperate. So that just opens the door to China just pushing countries around individually. And I thought that if countries could unite in pushing on the South China Sea, for example, or even, which is, this is not an issue that affects Malaysia, but the Mekong River, where China's blocking of storing water behind its 11 dams in the upper reaches of the Mekong is causing drought in the countries of the lower Mekong, Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam. If the countries of ASEAN would stand up to China and say, this isn't acceptable, we have to find ways to cooperate on sharing water, I think China would be reluctant to have a number of countries in the region standing up to it. And so I would really recommend that ASEAN countries do cooperate more in their dealings with China rather than go individually.
Mm. I guess I always wonder what is the source of this difficulty in coming together to compare notes, as you say. Why is it that we haven't been able to come together and, you know, have Malaysia say, for example, this issue of the Mekong River is important to Thailand and Vietnam and Laos, even if it isn't necessarily of direct importance to us, and let us stand together as a region? Is it something to do with kind of a post-colonial, almost death grip on our individual sovereignty that is at play here?
That's certainly one thing that's at play. The other is that countries just are very focused on doing their own development, economic development, and don't want to get sidetracked, I think, by picking up other agenda items in their dealings with China and then having China get irritated at them about that. But the countries are also just so different. You have countries that are fairly democratic, like Indonesia, you have communist countries like Vietnam, you have rich countries like Singapore, you have poor countries like Myanmar. You know, their countries are, besides their colonial history, are just really radically different. Their ethnicity is different, their religions are different. And so it's not really necessarily natural, even though they have had a partnership, at least the original countries have had a partnership for 50 years. They might sleep in the same bed, but they have different dreams, that's for sure.
That was Murray Hebert, author of the book Under Beijing's Shadow, Southeast Asia's China Challenge. And speaking of ties with Beijing, Malaysia's deepening trade and investment relations with China have raised concerns over whether we will fall prey to economic colonialism. Back in October, Khoo Soo Chuang spoke to a panel of University Malaya experts on whether we should be worried about China's influence.
Is the end goal economic colonialism?
I don't think we should make such strong statements. What we should look at are the trends, and we should try to interpret the implications of these trends. Now, as far as the China government is concerned, they have a BRI initiative, which is fine, and they are trying to expand their markets abroad, which a government should do. But what I am concerned about is the domestic governments, the Malaysian, the receiving states, if you like. How are they responding to this? Are they aware of what is happening in China? Are they ensuring that they are well protected? Mm. And that's what this book is also all about. The focus of the book is on Malaysia, not on China.
Yeah, that's right.
The focus is how is Malaysia responding to the investments from China. Mm-hmm. Malaysia is very well aware of what China is doing under the BRI. Malaysia is well aware of what has happened with China's investments in other parts of the world. So is Malaysia, while aware of this, in their public policies and their incentives to bring in these investments, taking care of the well-being of the country's economy?
That was Professor Edmund Terence Gomez and Dr. Cheong Kee Chok of University Malaya. The duo co-authored a new book titled China in Malaysia, State Business Relations and the New Order of Investment Flows. That caps our retrospective of interviews on geopolitics this year. You can listen to all the conversations featured today via podcast on the BFM app or on Spotify. This has been the Best of the Breakfast Grill 2020. I'm Lynn Mark for BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.